Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 161 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her empathy. Yeah, really provocative. Before we begin, just know that it's made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your reminder to click on to iTunes after this episode. We want to see you rate and review the show because we're sitting here just twiddling our thumbs waiting to hear from you. Yeah, that's right. Your feedback is that important. Plus, we just love to hear from you. Okay, so don't forget. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Huh. Empathy and feeling another's pain. Sad about. Well, we have the author of a provocative new book, which I just think is a must for you. It's called I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Ooh, I love that. Extreme Empathy. The author is Chris Beam. She's the author of several award-winning books, including To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. She's an assistant professor at William Patterson University and lives in New York City. Chris, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, so I was reading in the New York Times, trolling, as you will, under the book review. Always trolling because I am an author, so I'm always just scoping out what everyone else is doing too. And I ran right into your book, right? I Feel You. And I'm going to read a part of this review. We can only hope I Feel You is less a prescriptive self-help book than a thoughtful exploration of empathy in all its forms, physiological, historical, sociological, and even personal, as Beam struggles to transcend her own less than empathetic episodes and explore her aversion to opening herself to change. Self-empathy was code for selfish, she explains before signing up for a workshop on just that. One more link in a long chain of American entitlement. This is a radical book because it challenges the conventional wisdom that self-defense and punitive systems are the only way to keep ourselves physically and emotionally safe. And maybe more important, because it asserts that it's possible to work for the betterment of society without the accompanying side effect of feeling like a chump. Oh, my goodness, Chris, we have so much to talk about. So, I mean, what got you going on this extreme empathy thing in the first place?
Well, it was interesting. You know, I was writing it, so I started it about 4 years ago, and I kept seeing the word empathy everywhere. It was like a buzzword. You know, back in the 90s, I started noticing that people were researching empathy. That started with the mirror neurons. If you remember, when they were discovered in Italy, when they discovered that monkeys had these things called mirror neurons, they thought that they discovered the neurological basis for empathy. Mirror neurons have since been sort of critiqued. But it's when a monkey can, when a monkey witnesses another person or monkey doing something, their action neurons fire as though they're doing the action themselves. And so people thought, oh, well, this is empathy. This is how we neurologically perform empathy. And it sort of launched this avalanche of all things empathy, empathy and anger, empathy and music, empathy and everything. And, we started witnessing a lot of discussion around it. And then I started noticing that corporations started pushing empathy and I started getting really curious. Corporations have been sort of teaching empathy in their business schools. And they have all these terms like empathic branding and empathic marketing. So like when you're shopping for dog food and article about dogs comes up in your newsfeed, we might call that surveillance, but they call it empathy. And I argue that this isn't just a bastardization of a term. I think that this is a way in our online experience we begin to feel empathized with. It's a way that empathy has shifted to sort of mean something else.
I think a lot of people might be confused with the difference between sympathy and empathy. Why don't you give us an idea what that difference is?
Well, sympathy is has a component of action in it, where you want to alleviate somebody's a person's sorrow, usually. So it has an extra step to it. Empathy is merely being able to experience another's feeling or experience. That's all it is. It's just being able to experience somebody else's experience. That's it. It doesn't have an action to it. It's a precursor to good citizenship or to justice, but it doesn't have that step.
Interesting. All right. So, because that's important, I think they get confused big time.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
give us an example of empathy at work.
There's so many examples of empathy at work. I mean, it's interesting. There's empathy is, we talk about low-level empathy in babies. So when a baby hears another baby crying and cries himself, that's empathy. But that's just mirroring. So that's very low-level empathy, where we just experience another person's experience at a very low level and feel it and sort of mimic it. That's a kind of empathy. But then there's higher level empathy, where we add the imaginative element, where we sort of go, how would this feel for me to experience what you're experiencing? Or how would this feel for you to experience what you're experiencing? Those are two different sort of ideas around the sort of classic stepping into another person's shoes kind of thing. And we do that all the time, where we meet somebody and we recognize that they're experiencing usually some kind of suffering, and we imaginatively put ourselves into their shoes, so to speak.
Now, let me ask you an interesting question. Is there a gender specificity here? Do women empathize differently somehow than men?
I don't know. I don't know that anybody's ever studied that. And I don't know that, I don't know. It's an interesting question. I think that there are, there's the idea that there are people that are, the highly sensitive person. So people that feel a lot, and experience and are highly empathic. And I know that those tend to be more women tend to have that experience. So maybe. There may be more empathizers, or they may feel things at a different level. I mean, I think we're socialized as women to tune in to others and to cater to their needs. So there's a socialization factor. I don't know that, it's a sort of inherent. We don't know the neurological basis of empathy yet. We don't know.
Well, your point is extremely well taken, and I did that to be, provocative, which I was. And one of the thoughts I had, and you brought up something very important, and that is this socialization. And that is, it's been documented that that young boys are soon taught that it's uncool to show feelings, that to be able to really grossly sympathize and empathize may not be, macho enough, as it were. I'm being horribly generic right now, but we do have evidence that that is true. And females, I don't think uniformly are more empathetic because you have a wide spectrum, I would imagine, of experience.
Right.
I think that maybe what you've got is you have both gender, genetics, and environment all kicking in here. Environment clearly being the cultural norms and sociological, effect. I just want people to think about that. That's all. And if I could, you know, through this discussion stimulates more and maybe get some scientist out there, one of my fellow scientists, to kind of look at this closer, you know, it might be kind of interesting to understand, you know, because then when you look at things like look at societies ruled primarily by females versus males, do you have a different effect, right? You know, as you're looking at empathy as it relates to, you know, a lot of societal issues and experiences. So just something to kind of throw out there as a little monkey wrench in the entire discussion. But I just thought that was kind of neat. So looking at this empathy thing, what did you hope to accomplish by writing the book? Because the book is quite rich. So what... what was your outcome? What would make you happy?
You know, I was looking to understand what empathy was and to look for interesting ways that it was being deployed and where it was being sort of misapplied and where it was, where we were thinking about it, where it was being commodified, because I think it has been commodified in really unusual and sort of dangerous ways. So I wanted to look at
what's the most dangerous way.
I think that it's being taught in the schools now as a sort of skill rather than as a moral. It's being taught in the schools at such an enormous rate. Elementary schools and secondary schools as well are teaching empathy.
Forced. It's a bit forced. Right.
I mean, part of it is the anti-bullying thing, but a lot of it is there's a big corporate push again to teach empathy because they're looking for kids to grow up and have this skill, and they really see it as a skill rather than as a kind of moral art or a moral stance. And it's so therefore it's something that's, you know, numeratizable and gradable, something acquisitional. And I think it's really dangerous to think about empathy, which should be something that we do just for a moral good, just because it's good to be empathic toward our fellow human beings, as something that we can grade and see as a skill set, much like practicing the piano or something else. I think that that's actually a wrong-headed way to approach it.
Huh. So give us an example of how you do self-empathy, because you yourself noticed that it was hard, but how does one begin to develop that moral sense of self-empathy?
Well, self-empathy is different. Self-empathy is something that I was really resistant to, because I felt like it was selfish. And then I was in a relationship where my partner started beating me, and I had to get out while I was writing this book. And all of my regular skill sets didn't apply. You know, my just sort of like work hard and put my nose to the grindstone and do all that did no longer apply. I was suddenly flung into this universe that I didn't understand anymore. And, I was really scared and I was really vulnerable. And I started thinking about, I couldn't just work hard. I had to be kind to myself. And I had never had to do that before. And I realized that there was value in self-empathy. I realized that there was real value in being kind to oneself when you're suffering. That actually moves you forward and helps you to understand, the suffering of others. Because I had never been in a situation, I had never been in a domestic violence situation before. And, it really helped me move through the crisis. And so, all of the talk around self-empathy, that I had heard, I realized wasn't selfish. I realized that it was, sort of vital to getting through crisis.
Is there anything, called self-sympathy?
You know, there is, I think that people practice a whole range of things. I'm not an expert in self-sympathy. I think you can practice a whole range of tools, It's interesting. Why do you ask about self-sympathy?
I find it fascinating. I know for a fact that many of my patients get sympathy and empathy mixed up. And many times they don't even use the terms. They just say, well, I'm going to support myself. I want to, you know, do some self-support. And the other catch term is self-love, right? Self-love,
right.
Self-support.
Right.
And now what I'm doing is with your wonderful book on empathy, which really defines it and expands on it, both personally and societally, I'd like to make sure that people out there are really clear on how to begin to wrap their head around self-empathy, which I think is a really cool way of framing this. So that's why I was asking the question.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think self-empathy is just being able to recognize what your feelings are and feel them and be in tune with them and have generosity of spirit around them. And you know, just much the way you would experience someone else's pain, you can experience your own and be generous around that and not fight it. That's what I learned around self-empathy.
I love that.
And yeah.
Well, did that make it easier for you to practice it yourself? I mean, do you still struggle with it somewhat?
Yeah, it made it easier for me to empathize with others who have, you know, in the book I spend a lot of time in South Africa where I really think about empathizing with sort of the monster. I spend a lot of time with people who have committed gross crimes against humanity. So I really think about the big, big picture of like people who have inflicted tremendous trauma on others. So I get really big. It helped me to have empathy for those who have really suffered once I had done this intensive internal examination of what it means to suffer.
All right. And, you know, going to sort of the neuroscience end of this, there are certain parts of the brain that light up, right, with empathy. And they are the antithesis of the parts of the brain that light up with anger and hatred and very negative feelings. And a consequence of really engendering empathy are very beneficial things, and that is a decrease in stress hormone, for instance, cortisol, which is always good because that decreases overall body inflammation, which is always good because that's the basis of most disease, mental and physical. So there seems to be a nice domino effect there. So in addition to, you know, feeling better, just generally speaking, and being more open when you're empathetic, whether to self or to others, you're also doing nice things for your body, too. You go into that in the book, right?
I do a little bit. You know, we don't really understand a lot of the neurological basis for empathy or how it works, because it seems to involve a large chunk of neural real estate. So it's not like there's a place that we can say here in the brain is neurobiologically where it lights up. I talked with Kent Keel, who does brain scans of criminal psychopaths. He found that there's a significant chunk of neural real estate that is in the paralimbic system that is atrophied.
That's correct.
In psychopaths. And we don't know whether this is causal or, you know, whether it's, you know, chicken or egg situation, you know, what happened first, whether they were born this way or whether it happened because of the actions that they took. But we do know that it's a pretty large area, so it's really hard to say, you know, where in the brain it happens. But I do talk about that, and you know, it's interesting. There's somebody in Australia named Mark Dads who's doing some interesting work around teaching young kids with some of these, like, we don't call children psychopaths or sociopaths. We describe them as having callous, unemotional traits. And he's done some really interesting work around teaching them to have eye contact and seeing if we can sort of reverse some of this sort of neural programming. So we don't know. We don't know if it can be reversed, but it does look like there is. I don't know if this is getting to your question. I'm kind of getting around it, but yes, there, I do talk about some of the neuroanatomy in there, mostly around.
Yeah, I think that there's no question that there's no simple answer in terms of, well, there's this one discrete area that lights up like Kyoto at nighttime. It doesn't.
Right.
But you know, there are complex neural networks associated with this that I would imagine involve the limbic system, the frontal cortex, the reward center, as well as a whole cascade of hormonal systems involving connectivity. That's your oxytocin, your prolactin, and others. But really, one can infer from the science that does exist that it's all good. I mean, you feel good when you're empathetic. I mean, when I say good, you may be, not happy with the fact that, you know, you're watching someone suffer somewhere. Maybe you see it on the news or whatever, and you feel great empathy toward that. But at the same time, there's something deep and warm and connecting that's going on inside of you. You're not numb. You're not indifferent. You're something else, right? You're definitely not negative.
Yeah,
and so
it's very base. It's one
does
of
that
our
make
primary.
Sense?
Yeah, and it's one of our primary. It's one of our primary modes. I mean, we learn it. We don't even learn it. It's very foundational. It's something that happens when we're infants. I mean, you stick out a tongue and a baby sticks out a tongue. That mirroring effect is empathy. Is empathy. And then as we get to be a little bit older, it starts to shift. But it becomes, you know, at age two, you know, the kids are doing, you recognize that other people have feelings, but you think that they're the same as yours. And then at age three, you recognize people can have different feelings than your own. And then in like fourth grade, you begin to recognize that people have different life circumstances than your own. So it gets more and more complex, but it's pretty inborn, this empathy thing. So it's something that's really wonderful because it's both learned and inherent, and sort of nurtured as you grow.
All right, now as our Her podcast listeners are scribbling notes madly out there, I want to give them a little bit of homework here, something that they could do. And this was brought out in the New York Times piece, which I'd like you to expand on. It said, next time you have an argument with a spouse, coworker, or teenager, stop fighting for a minute and try repeating back to them exactly what they've said to you without editorializing or over dramatizing. It's a humbling experience. Explain to us this little homework we can now do.
You know, it was interesting. I took a course in empathic listening, and one of the things that we did was simply repeat back to one another what the other said. And when we altered what the other person said, when we tried to like repeat it back with our own inflection or our own understanding, the person felt less heard than when we simply parroted it. And it seems sort of counterintuitive. You'd think that the person would feel more heard if you added your own inflection, if you added your own brush strokes to it. But the person always, like without fail, felt more heard if you said it exactly the way they said it. So it was a really interesting exercise to just repeat back what the person said. And invariably, we feel like, oh, you get me, because you listened and you repeated back. And that very simple exercise is a form of very simple empathy. And it's interesting. There are so many definitions of empathy. That's a very simple one. But, There's a person named Nell Noddings who says that the whole notion of projecting yourself into another person's experience is a particularly Western masculine notion of empathy. And she defines empathy as receptivity. And this exercise is a kind of, it's a more receptive exercise where you're literally just taking in what the other person says and repeating it back without trying to put your own feet in the other person's shoes, without trying to project any imaginative experience. You're literally just receiving. Another definition that I really like a lot is mutual vulnerability. And that's where you're just sort of mutually being vulnerable to the other's experience. You're not trying to let one be dominant. You're just being vulnerable to the other's experience. And that's
give us an example of that. What's an example of that?
Of mutual vulnerability?
Yes.
When I was in South Africa, I was thinking a lot about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and learning a lot more about those. So the TRCs where people would, face their accusers, face their perpetrators, after genocide, basically, and after gross human rights violations and after murders, and they would tell their story, and the perpetrator would have to just listen, and then the perpetrator would get to speak back, and very often there would be a form of apology, and it wasn't forced. It was not like our criminal justice system where we're forced to come up with a verdict of guilty or not guilty. It was just storytelling and then listening and then allowing a space for the person to talk back. And that's the kind of mutual vulnerability where one sees the common humanity in the other. And when a person is vulnerable enough to tell what their experience is,
right,
very often the other will be vulnerable back. And will offer up unsolicited a kind of apology.
In many respects, I see that as extreme empathy, because that's a hard one. That's a hard one.
It's a very hard
one. Yeah. And I like that whole term, extreme empathy. I think it really rocks, because what it does for me when I read it was it drew my attention to empathy. Otherwise, it's like, oh, God, here we go again with another, you know, empathy push. But then I thought,
right,
well, now, wait a minute. There's something else going on. And I think you described that beautifully in your book. Everyone out there in the Herb podcast land, just know that we have been talking to Chris Beam. And she is the author of just a fabulous book, an extremely unique and maverick approach to this whole issue of empathy. And the name of the book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. And please go to her website at Chris Beam, I'll spell that, that's CRISBEAM.com, ChrisBeam.com, to be able to learn about her other work and her thoughts, and more about extreme empathy for sure. And I would really highly recommend you get this book, because if there's one thing we need in this world today, it's more empathy, let alone extreme empathy. Chris, I want to thank you so much for being on this amazing episode for the Her podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just keep up the marvelous work. I mean, we need a heck of a lot more of this, especially in this challenging world.
Thank you so much.
Of course. And everyone else, remember to go to Chris's website to be able to learn more about her work. And that's chrisbeam.com. And now, right now, run on over to iTunes, rate and review this show, because I'm waiting to hear from you. This has been a very provocative show. Tell me what you think about empathy. I'm Dr. Pam Peake, host of the Her podcast. So you just come on down and follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peake or Twitter at Pam Peake MD. And remember to catch every episode of the Her podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today, and stay well.